and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Bernie Sanders addressing the annual meeting of Walmart shareholders today, at which he shamed the company's executives and the Walton family owners, who are among the richest families in the world, pointing out that, quote, Walmart workers are sick and tired of being paid starvation wages. Later, Sanders joined Representative Ocasio-Cortez and economist Robert Hockett for a town hall on Twitter to discuss their bill, the Loan Shark Prevention Act, which puts a 15% cap on all consumer loans. Robert Hockett, a professor of law at Cornell Law School who helped Elizabeth Warren write the Accountable Capitalism Act and is currently a public finance advisor to Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and helped write the Green New Deal and the Loan Shark Prevention Act, joins us. We'll discuss how, since usury laws were overturned by the banking lobby, banks and credit card companies in states like South Dakota and Delaware are able to charge as much as 23% on money they borrow from the Federal Reserve at 2.5%. Starting in the 1980s with Ronald Reagan, this has turned America from an income-based economy to a credit-driven consumer economy, with most of the gains of increased productivity going to the 1%, while most Americans haven't had a raise since the late 1970s. We'll also discuss Elizabeth Warren's latest plan, which she calls an agenda for economic patriotism. Then we'll speak with Shireen Aladimi, a professor of education at Michigan State University, who has lived through two civil wars in her native Yemen and is now playing an active role in raising awareness of the humanitarian atrocities underway in the U.S.-supported Saudi-led war in Yemen. She joins us to discuss her article at In These Times, Why Nancy Pelosi Needs to Sue the Trump Administration Over the Yemen War, and how U.S. senators led by Lindsey Graham are pushing back against the Trump administration's transfer of nuclear technology and arms sales to Saudi Arabia. Then finally, we'll examine the escalation of Trump's trade war with Mexico, in which he has tied the border and immigration issues to ramping up tariffs unless Mexico stops migrant flows into the United States, which the much richer United States, with far more resources, has not been able to accomplish. Catherine Russ, a professor of economics at the University of California, Davis, who worked on the Obama administration's Council of Economic Advisers as a senior economist for international trade and finance, joins us to discuss today's White House talks between Vice President Pence and Mexico's foreign minister that went nowhere, and how retaliatory tariffs by Mexico could hurt Trump's re-election chances in important swing states. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Robert Hockett, who's a professor of law at Cornell Law School, whose research focuses on organizational, financial, and monetary law and economics in their national and transnational dimensions, a fellow of the Century Foundation, and a commissioned author for the New America Foundation. He also does regular consulting work for the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, the International Monetary Fund, Americans for Financial Reform, the Occupy Cooperative, and a number of federal and state legislators and local governments. He recently helped Senator Elizabeth Warren write the Accountable Capitalism Act and is currently a public finance advisor to Bernie Sanders and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And he helped write the Green New Deal and the Loan Shark Prevention Act. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Hockett.
Thanks so much, Ian. Great to be with you again.
Well, thank you, Robert. And you have been on a conference call, I guess, a virtual town hall with Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez today. So tell us what you were talking about and what the results of this electronic town hall are so far.
Sure. So it was actually a Twitter equivalent to that. We were basically just tweeting back and forth. And what we were essentially doing is talking about the Loan Shark Prevention Act and an expert's letter that we circulated and found quite a few people excited to sign, including former chief economist at the World Bank, several very distinguished academic economists, law professors, private practitioners, private equity fund managers, you name it, sort of across the board.
Well, Bernie Sanders apparently has had a busy day today because he was at the Walmart shareholders meeting, was he not?
Yes. Absolutely amazing.
Yeah. So did he tell you anything about how that went? Because I caught a bit of it on the radio, but I haven't.
Yeah.
I've been tired.
I'm dying, actually. You might know more than I do at the moment, Ian. I'm dying, actually, to hear myself. Maybe you can tell me. We just finished the sort of Twitter town hall just a couple of minutes ago. So I've been sort of out of the Walmart loop since about 2 p.m. Eastern time this afternoon. but as of this morning, at least, it was looking to be, you know, right on course and looking to be very exciting. I thought, what a wonderful thing, right, to be a shareholder in Walmart and having Bernie Sanders going as your proxy to the shareholder meeting.
Right, but to make
wonderful.
But to make a point that resonates with me and a lot of people is why should us ordinary taxpayers subsidize America's wealthiest family, if not the not the wealthiest, one of the wealthiest families, because they're too damn cheap to pay their workers enough, and their workers have to go on public assistance.
Yeah, I mean, I think Senator Sanders is just spot on about this, right? It's a bit of a scandal, isn't it, that we have to provide a social safety net because the private sector itself doesn't pay people enough to live on, right? And then when we try to sort of, finance all of that safety net, or at least sort of prevent inflationary pressure from developing as a result of the public expenditures that go into that safety net by adding to the tax take, of course, we're objected to on that score, right? So not only do they not want to pay their workers a living wage, but they also don't want to pay their fair share into the public fisc when the public itself puts the bill.
So since you're the public finance advisor to Bernie Sanders and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Robert Hockett, and you helped write the Green New Deal and the Loan Shark Prevention Act, tell us about this new initiative, which is to cap all interest rates at 15%. I mean, I know it's a part of the Loan Shark Prevention Act, but that's the headline grabber.
Yeah, so the basic idea here, and I should emphasize that it's Congresswoman and the Senator themselves who really did the bulk of the writing and the drafting, and I basically just tried to be helpful in sort of talking about the stuff with them and helping to get the word out. But the basic idea here is sort of twofold. The first is because there's a great deal of oligopoly-style concentration in the banking and lending markets more generally, there's a tendency for many lenders to charge really exorbitant interest rates and fees and the like. And that's especially apt to happen in inner city areas and other sort of relatively less densely populated areas where the banking institutions just don't find it profitable to sort of locate themselves. So when you have oligopoly or even monopoly conditions of that sort in some circumstances, there's a tendency really to jack up the interest rates and the fees and to charge people truly exorbitant rates. So what we're trying to do is essentially, on the one hand, put a cap on those sorts of rates and fees that can be charged, while at the same time offering a public option when it comes to sort of retail banking, retail lending, retail credit services, and the like. This used to be quite common. We used to have a public option of this sort. Almost every other developed economy in the world has one or more public options of this sort, even now. So what we want to do is bring that back while at the same time, again, prohibiting the existing lenders from engaging in usury of the kind that they do now and the kind that we used to prohibit.
Well, under Trump, these bottom feeders have been given, you know, free rein. And the worst part about it is that these payday lenders tend to congregate around military bases. I know that the wife of General Petraeus was trying to do something about it during the Obama administration, but it is horrible. And how does it tie into the general overall change that took place under Ronald Reagan? Prior to Ronald Reagan, Americans actually had savings accounts, and their wages kept a pace with the cost of living. But then under Reagan, they brought in credit in a big way, which gave the average American, working, middle-class American, the illusion that they were still keeping a pace with the cost of living. because of the availability of credit. And, of course, this was a massive – and this was also the same period when pensions were eviscerated and big corporations stopped having to pay into pension funds, and then they moved to the stock market with the 401ks. To my mind, that was one of the most profound shifts in America that went under the radar, and it's led to – a much more indentured American public, in the sense that that they really are all in debt. The statistics indicate that the average American family, I think at least 40-something percent of Americans, are a $400 emergency payment away from penury. I mean, I know I'm sort of throwing out a bunch of different things here, but I do believe there's a connection.
There's a very important connection, and I think you put your finger right on probably the single most important economic and social development in this country over the last 40 years. So, you know, up until the mid to late 1970s, we had a kind of implicit, if not explicit, social contract, Ian. And what that was essentially that as the productivity of the country grew over time, there was a roughly equitable division of the spoils of that productivity growth between owners of capital on the one hand and those who supplied labor on the other. Now, what that meant for people like you and me, because the overwhelming majority of Americans, well over 90%, rely primarily on labor incomes as their principal sources of income, what that meant for us before the late 1970s was that our incomes grew in real terms as our economy grew. And that meant that basically purchasing power within our economy grew in tandem with productive capacity on the part of our economy. And that's one reason we had more or less stable growth without a bunch of recessions or depressions or crises, you know, through the 50s, 60s, and a good part of the 70s. What changed in the late 70s and early 80s and really gathered pace and accelerated during the Reagan years was that that social contract was broken and torn up. In effect, what we decided, well, we didn't decide it, but somebody decided that all of the gains would now go to the top 1 to 10% of the population, while everybody else, all of us who work for a living and derive most of our incomes from labor, didn't get any of that growth at all. And indeed, for many, many people, real incomes diminished. Now, that meant there were two problems, right? One, there was a justice problem, but there was also a long-term lag in consumer demand problem. That's the kind of thing that causes recessions and depressions. So what public officials seem to have decided to do is they recognize that we need to maintain purchasing power in order to keep the economy growing and keep the unemployment rate from growing too high. But God help us, you know, they're certainly not going to buttress wages and salaries in the way that they used to back up into the late 70s. So they decided to rely on credit instead, but very exploitative credit. So we've essentially been a credit-driven consumer economy since the 80s, whereas before that, we were an income-driven consumer economy. And that is the source of the overwhelmingly greater part of our financial, economic, social, and even political problems to this day.
Well, thank you, Robert, for really crystallizing what I was floundering around trying to explain.
Oh, you were saying it quite well, Ian.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Robert Hockett, who's a professor of law at Cornell Law School, whose research focuses on organizational, financial, and monetary law and economics in their national and transnational dimensions, a fellow at the Century Foundation, and a regular author for the New America Foundation. He also does regular consulting work for the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, the International Monetary Fund, Americans for Financial Reform, the Occupy Cooperative, and a number of federal and state legislators and local governments. And he recently helped Senator Elizabeth Warren write the Accountable Capitalism Act and is currently a public finance advisor to Bernie Sanders and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And he helped write the Green New Deal and the Loan Shark Prevention Act. So it's a bit odd to my mind that Bernie Sanders and, well, the front runner, of course, on the Democratic side is Joe Biden, followed by Bernie Sanders. But curiously, they don't seem to be getting a lot of press, which is a little strange. But Elizabeth Warren is. And to some extent, she deserves it because she's one of the candidates who puts out new ideas. And eventually, it seems that most of the others seem to, you know, adopt them. Her latest call is, quote, it's called Agenda for Economic Patriotism. So that's, to my mind, is a really good basis for running against this phony populist who basically conned a bunch of working class people into voting for him. And now he's just stiffing them in the worst possible way. I don't know whether you saw yesterday's op-ed in the New York Times. It listed all of the attacks on labor by the Trump administration. It's just pernicious and across the board.
Sub-working class populist, right?
Right, exactly. But the real deal appears to be Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah, I think it's definitely Bernie and Elizabeth, and to a certain extent, also Kirsten Gillibrand, who I don't think is getting quite the attention she ought to be getting either. I've been telling people that we have somewhere between 2.5 and 3 really great candidates for working Americans right now in the Democratic Party. The two obvious ones and the two who have sort of been longest on record doing this kind of thing, I think, are Bernie Sanders and Liz Warren. I think that Kirsten Gillibrand is sort of up and coming in this realm, too. She's got a great deal of interest in worker ownership and in public investment banks that would revitalize our infrastructure and our manufacturing base. So we'll probably be hearing more from her soon on this, too. But for the time being and for some time, it's been primarily Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. And what they're really big on is a number of things, right? First is they want labor to have a much greater say in the way we conduct our productive activities in this country. And there are two ways to do that, of course. One is to increase worker ownership and to foster and spread it. And another, of course, is to get employee co-determination on the boards of corporations. And both Bernie and Liz are pushing both of those agendas when it comes to the way corporations operate in this country. And note how that speaks directly to the thing that you and I were talking about a moment ago, the declining labor share of the national income and the fact that all of that share, basically the entirety of it now, goes just to the owners of capital. If you can actually get workers to own capital in addition to owning their labor power, you partly address that. And then also if you have labor involved in co-determination of corporate decision-making by sitting on the boards, you partly address that. So that's one part of what they're doing. And again, Senator Gillibrand is going to be pushing the same kinds of things. She's already working on those sorts of things. She just doesn't get as much attention for it yet, but she will. And then the second thing to note is that when it comes to the infrastructure and the industrial policy of this country to ensure that we actually have, you know, working roads, bridges, transport systems, water systems, all sorts of, you know, basically the kind of architecture that private firms need in order to produce effective and efficiently, and that an economy needs in order to be integrated and productive as one unit. When it comes to that sort of thing, too, Republicans have been sort of impoverishing the country, and many austerian Democrats have been impoverishing it, too, letting the roads decay and decline, letting our transport systems decay and decline, letting water systems, power systems, and so forth decay and decline. And that, of course, operates as a very significant long-term drag on growth and on wealth production and on the well-being of the country as a whole. Liz and Bernie are very big on that as well. Senator Warren is pushing very hard on that, as is Senator Sanders. And again, Senator Gillibrand will be joining the pack on this too. But that's a little bit misleading to put it that way. She's been part of this all along, but again, she's going to make it a much bigger piece, I think, of her, or much more emphasized part of her platform going forward. So that's another very important part of the picture here. And I think that by, you know, sort of pushing on both of those fronts at the same time, again, manufacturing and infrastructure on the one hand, and then employee empowerment on the other hand, that really is the key, I think, to reversing all of the decline that's been underway since the late 1970s that we were talking about a moment ago.
Well, Bernie Sanders, of course, did bring up that very issue today at the Walmart shareholders meeting, where he called for workers in Walmart to be put on the board, which they, by the way, is the law in Germany. All major German corporations have quite a high percentage of board members as union representatives. And
that's
nobody
right.
can
yeah,
deny
exactly.
the fact that the Germans have a very healthy economy and an amazing export economy. So,
that's exactly right, yeah. They call it co-determination.
Right.
They call it co-determination. The German economy has been very, very successful over the decades. And as you said, nobody can accuse it of being unsuccessful or inefficient or ineffective as an exporting power. It's sort of funny, isn't it, that the countries that do best are the ones that do the kinds of things that Senators Sanders and Warren especially, and to a degree now Senator Gillibrand as well, have been pushing.
So Senator Warren's agenda for economic patriotism, basically it wants to restructure some of the government departments and create the Department of Economic Development, which would replace the Commerce Department, led by a grifter at the moment, a horrible guy, and whose only claim to shame is probably eclipsed by the Secretary of Transportation whose family owned a big shipping company, and she has jurisdiction over that. But nevertheless, we know we have a team of grifters in Trump cabinet. But the idea of Elizabeth Warren's is to create the Department of Economic Development with replacing the Commerce Department, the Small Business Administration, the Patent and Trademark Office, and the U.S. Trade Representative, and basically turning the whole thing around with a single goal, which is to create and defend good American jobs. And she goes on to say, these American companies, talking about the current status quo, these American companies show only one real loyalty to the short-term interests of their shareholders, a third of whom are foreign investors. If they can close up an American factory and ship jobs overseas to save a nickel, that's exactly what they will do, abandoning loyal American workers and hollowing out American cities along the way. So what do you think the chances are of this idea of economic patriotism catching on in this campaign?
I think the chances are very, very good, Ian, for a couple of reasons. First, I'm just going to say I'm entirely ecstatic about this. I'm in ecstasy about this proposal. I was talking to the Warren team late last autumn and with the Sanders team late last autumn about this, and we're all on the same page about this idea that the one way to think about this is think that, you know, development is never a done deal, right? We tend to think of development as something that a country or an economy goes through. It's underdeveloped or undeveloped, then it becomes developed, and then that's it. You know, that's you're done. But we shouldn't think of development that way. Development is forever. Development is a lifelong thing. Or as the great poet Robert Zimmerman, better known as Bob Dylan, once put it, he not busy being born is busy dying. If you want an economy to continue to be healthy throughout its existence, you've got to think of development as a national project that's always underway. So that's the first point. Second point, I think there's a great deal of hope that we might do something along these lines, even with some Republican buy-in. Because here's another person I haven't mentioned yet, and I have to say I was very pleasantly surprised by this, but Senator Marco Rubio of Florida has recently put out two very interesting, very thoughtful, and really quite visionary white papers, and I would encourage everybody to go to his website to find these two. One is on the role that the Chinese state plays in Chinese development and Chinese export policy, and then the other is in the deficit in actual public investment, especially infrastructure and manufacturing investment in this country, and what we can do as a public to remedy that 40-year decline. So there appears to be an appetite among even some Republicans, but especially, of course, visionary Democrats like Senator Sanders and Senator Warren, and of course, her proposal yesterday is the most exciting thing I've seen along these lines in my entire lifetime. There's a lot of hope, a lot of intention, it seems, among them as well to move forward on this, to do this again. And I might add one final thing in this connection, Ian, and that is this model, this way of looking at development as a never-ending thing and as a thing that the public itself plays a role in fostering and supporting is an originally American idea. This was the vision of Alexander Hamilton. This was the Hamiltonian development program that made this country a great industrial and commercial power as it became throughout the course of the 19th century. And all of the later countries that became great at this got the idea from us, right? The architect of the German in the late 19th century was an economist named Friedrich List, L-I-S-T, quoted Hamilton ad libitum. Similarly, after the restoration in Japan, when Japan decided to rocket itself into the modern era in the late 19th and early 20th century, they cited Hamilton. And then after that, all of the Asian tiger nations, including South Korea and now China, all cited Hamilton. What an irony that the only country that isn't following the Hamiltonian playbook anymore is Alexander Hamilton's very home, his home nation, the United States. So you can actually think of Elizabeth Warren, especially right now, but also Senator Sanders, and also I think in the near future, Senator Gillibrand, and even Senator Rubio now, as sort of neo-Hamiltonians. They're bringing back that Hamiltonian vision and Hamiltonian tradition to American development policy, which is going to become American economic policy.
Well, to my mind, Robert Hockett, anything that makes Americans feel like we're all in it together, that we all have a stake, that we all have a place in this country. And that's what social democracies engender. The idea, you know, you pay your taxes, but you get your services, and it's a fair transaction, and everybody pays their fair share, particularly the rich, which they did under Eisenhower, 92% taxation. So my sense is that if the average American felt they'd had a stake in this country, The thing that troubles me so much, and I get so much mail from people on the left that are totally alienated and believe that the deep state is behind everything that goes wrong, and the right-wingers believe that same stuff. And it all, to my mind, it's just pathetic. It's like, it's your goddamn government. Wake up. Take it over. You know, to my mind, that has been a pernicious plan on the part of the oligarchs and the right in this country to decouple people from their civic understanding of democracy, to decouple them from their sense of being a part of this country. As long as you can go to the mall and buy stuff, that makes you an American. Remember after 9/11, George W. Bush said, go to the mall. Well, this I'm talking about something far deeper than that. And if these people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and AOC can help put that forth, that we can have a social compact, we can all have a stake in this country, we can all work together, but it's got to be fair.
So I think, I mean, this is another pet peeve or pet concern of mine, Ian, so unsurprisingly, you and I are on the same page yet again. You know, I think one of the greatest disservices that Ronald Reagan did to this country was to encourage people to think of the government as the government and hence as the other, as something other. But, you know, at the same, in the same breath, Reagan would be saying we're a great democracy. But those are two inconsistent claims. You can't claim that we're a democracy on the one hand and then claim that the government is something alien or other on the other hand, because if we're a democracy, it's not the government, it's our government, which is another way of saying that it is us, right? You know, we have two first-person pronouns in the English language. One is the first-person singular, I. The other is the first-person plural, we. Now, we often use the word we, even as I'm using it right now, and indeed, oftentimes when we talk about American policy or we talk about American wars or America's sort of place in the world or the safety and soundness of the, of our country, we talk about our country, we talk about we, not about I. And that's the way we should think about our government, right? And when our government is acting in ways that we don't think it ought to be acting, then it is effectively acting a bit like a rogue agent who's not acting according to his or her duties to the principal, right? And the government is our, you know, the government is our agent, and we are the principal. We're a plural principal who are, you know, have this agent or these various instrumentalities that are working in our name and on our behalf, and that's what our government is. So the thing to do, it seems to me, is to stop thinking of the government as an alien thing, stop thinking of taxes as something that are being imposed on us by sort of alien forces, and think of these as dues that we pay into our club, so to speak, because it is, after all, our club, and think about ways to make our club act more effectively in the name of us all and for the benefit of us all, and that just is the social compact that you mentioned, and indeed, it used to be the social compact that I think all Americans recognized until the sort of destructive rhetoric of the late 1970s and early 80s began to sort of set in, thanks largely to Reagan, but not solely to Reagan.
Well, Robin Harkett, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, thanks so much, Ian. Always a great pleasure to talk with you.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Robert Harkett, who's a professor of law at Cornell Law School, whose research focuses on organizational, financial, and monetary law and economics in their national and transnational dimensions. He's a fellow of the Century Foundation and regular author for the New American Foundation. He does regular consulting work for the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, the International Monetary Fund, Americans for Financial Reform, the Occupy Cooperative, and a number of federal and state legislatures. And he recently helped Senator Elizabeth Warren write the Accountable Capitalism Act, and he's currently a public finance advisor to Bernie Sanders and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and he helped write the Green New Deal and the Loan Shark Prevention Act. We're going to take a brief station break and back, looking into how U.S. senators led by Lindsey Graham are pushing back against the Trump administration's transfer of nuclear technology and arms sales to Saudi Arabia.
Got a nightlife off the day job. Pushing paper, swinging pendulums. Anything to serve a function or to occupy some time. You gotta earn this living somehow. You're good as dead without a bank account. But it's funny how a life you felt down in that unemployment line with all that trash.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Shireen Aladimi, who's a professor of education at Michigan State University. Having lived through two civil wars in her country of birth, Yemen, she has played an active role in raising awareness about the U.S.-supported Saudi-led war on Yemen since 2015. Through her work, she aims to encourage political action among fellow Americans to bring about an end to U.S. intervention in Yemen. And she has an article at In These Times, Why Nancy Pelosi Needs to Sue the Trump Administration Over the Yemen War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Shireen Aladimi.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, thank you for joining us, and we'll get into your article in a minute, but I just wanted to start out talking about what's going on in the United States Senate with U.S. senators wanting to block Trump from selling arms to Saudi Arabia without their approval. Apparently, the administration has been sending nuclear technology to Saudi Arabia without the approval of the Senate and the Congress. And one of the senators that looked into it has had a hard time getting any response from the Department of Energy about what happened. And eventually Senator Kaine was told that essentially it happened twice. And the first transfer of nuclear technology to Saudi Arabia happened only days, or the approval at the White House happened only days after Khashoggi was murdered, and it was pretty clear that he was murdered on orders from Mohammed bin Salman. So it seems to me that the lawmakers in the Senate, led by all people, Lindsey Graham, who's a big supporter of the president, along with Chris Murphy, Rand Paul, Patrick Leahy, Todd Young of Indiana, Jack Reed of Rhode Island, and Tim Kaine, as I mentioned, they're basically threatening they'll hold up the Senate effectively with 22 separate votes taking 10 hours apiece as their way to put pressure on Senate Majority Mitch McConnell, whose agenda will not be able to move. I suppose they're assuming that even if the majority of the Senate vote against the Trump administration, he'll override the veto. They need 67 votes. So I'm trying to sketch out the current situation. Is there anything you would add to that, Shireen?
Right. I think what we're seeing here is Congress trying to reassert its authority over the president's abuse of his executive powers. We've seen it with the War Powers Resolution, with Trump vetoing a congressional bill that aims to end the U.S.'s role in Yemen. And now we're seeing that he's bypassing Congress altogether to try to sell these arms and has been, clearing these arms deals for Saudi Arabia without congressional approval, without congressional review. So it seems that Graham and these senators, Menendez and the ones you mentioned, are mounting this effort to try to reassert their constitutional powers away from this abuse of executive powers that we've seen with Trump.
And would you assume, as I do, that it's unlikely that they get enough votes in the Senate to override presidential veto?
I think it's unlikely. The push, unfortunately, is not with Trump acting in this way behind closed doors, perhaps we won't have enough votes in the Senate to be able to stop these deals from going through. And he has been doing this, like you said, for a while, and has not been forthcoming with Congress, with the Senate, about what's going on. So I think it'll be difficult to stop them, but this is a worthwhile effort for sure.
Well, since the effort is led by Senator Lindsey Graham, again, a close ally and a defender of the president, he's saying it's now time to rein in the administration's Middle East policy. Quoting the senator today, "While I understand that Saudi Arabia is a strong ally, the behavior of Mohammed bin Salman cannot be ignored. Now is not the time to do business as usual with Saudi Arabia. I'm also very concerned about the precedent these arms sales would set by having the administration go around legitimate concerns of the Congress." So you'd think that Graham would be able to pull a few fellow senators, but not enough for an override, I take it.
I hope so, but what concerns me is that, Senator Graham has been speaking about this since the murder of Khashoggi last August, but we also have the NDAA coming up, the National Defense Authorization Act of 2020, so it would be really important to try to defund the war, defund arms sales through the NDAA. So if Graham and other Republicans are serious about this, there's an opportunity to defund the war through the NDAA. Again, we know that Trump could veto, but that's another avenue to take. So besides these 22 resolutions that they've they've announced they can also work through the NDAA and try to defund the war through that, or, you know, these arms sales.
But just to finish up on the Senate here, with the threat by the senators to force 22 votes blocking arms sales to Saudi Arabia, that each vote would take up about 10 hours of Senate time. And as you know, the senators only work a couple of days a week. So that's obviously aimed at getting Mitch McConnell's attention, that the Senate's right. going to be tied up for a while and he won't be able to get his judges through, et cetera. Not that he's doing anything else except getting judges through. Do you think that tactic going to work?
I think it's definitely worth pursuing. This does need to be brought to Mitch McConnell's attention. He seems to have given Trump a pass on all of these abuses of executive powers so far. And so an action like this, I think, will definitely get his attention at the very least.
So turning to your article, why Nancy Pelosi needs to sue the Trump administration over the Yemen war, walk us through your argument, if you will, Shireen.
So the idea here is that when, first of all, the U.S.'s intervention in Yemen is illegal. Neither Obama nor Trump gained congressional approval for their war in Yemen, and it does constitute a violation of the Constitution, since the Constitution allows Congress to declare war and not the president. And so neither president had congressional approval, and now we see Trump in open defiance of not only the Constitution but also Congress's decision. It took a couple of years, but Congress finally passed SJRES 7, which prohibits U.S. intervention in Yemen, further U.S. intervention in Yemen, and Trump simply vetoed that. So the idea is that his veto should be illegal because it is in violation of the Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. And so now there's a group of people, both activists and groups within the legal community, who are arguing that a lawsuit should be brought forward by Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House, and to challenge Trump's veto of this congressional decision to end the war in Yemen, because, again, his veto is in violation of the Constitution.
So have you heard anything from the House? I mean, we talked about what the Senate is trying to do, and, of course, the House has its hands full trying to deal with the non-response from the administration, from the various subpoenas that have been issued in the wake of the Mueller report, and also, of course, lots of wrangling going on with the Democratic caucus over whether or not to impeach Trump or to proceed with an impeachment inquiry. Have you heard anything from the House?
Not from Pelosi, but President or Congressman Ro Khanna's office has been very vocal in support of this measure to sue President Trump. And I'm hoping various activist communities are hoping that more Congress people can jump on board. Anybody could be on this lawsuit, and it should be of interest to any person in Congress who voted for the War Powers Act to try to protect the Constitution from this president, let alone, you know, protecting Yemeni citizens from this U.S.-led war in Yemen. And we're hoping that Nancy Pelosi's office will make a statement soon. She has not responded to the letter that was sent to her by a group of constitutional scholars led by Bruce Ackerman of Yale University. She's not responded to that. She's not made a public statement yet in response to activist groups sending her a letter either. But we're hoping that this is going to gain momentum, because this seems to be a really good chance, a really good opportunity to challenge Trump's war. You know, he's prioritized his relationship with the Saudis and profit, of course, over human lives and also over the laws of this country. So if we have a law prohibiting the president from declaring war and we just allow the president to veto that decision when it's a congressional decision, then what's the point of having this law as a federal act? So it's worth protecting for sure.
So what do you think is going on here with the Trump administration skirting around congressional strictures and transferring nuclear technology to Saudi Arabia? And they did it twice. And the first time they did it was shortly after the murder of Khashoggi, at the time when the finger was being pointed at Mohammed bin Salman. So what does Saudi Arabia need nuclear technology for, and why would it be done in secret?
Well, it wouldn't be approved by Congress, which is why it has to be done through Trump. And he's had Pompeo basically declare a quote-unquote emergency and that they're trying to bypass Congress so that they can get these arms sales without Congress, because supposedly there's an emergency in the region with Iran acting as a, quote, fundamental threat to the stability of the Middle East and American society, security. And I think the Saudis have been very successful, essentially, because for years now they've been arguing, they've been making the case that Iran is a threat in the region. Iran is the mastermind in Yemen with very little evidence, of course. And this has been repeated in the U.S. without much scrutiny. And now, unfortunately, Yemenis are going to continue to pay the price of this misinformation that's causing Trump to declare this fake emergency, security emergency, related to the escalation of his war or, you know, war rhetoric with Iran. And the Saudis, at the end of the day, are interested in power and in imperialist agendas. And Trump, of course, is interested in making billions of dollars worth in weapon sales and all other kind of military services that they provide to the Saudis, and has shown a complete disregard for, of course, human lives and the laws of this country in trying to bypass Congress to do this.
But this is a very dangerous neighborhood, and there's something of a hair trigger going on in any case with threats against Iran and counter threats from Iran, which the president himself had to step in and stop Bolton because things were getting out of hand. And he was more or less told, you know, you could have a war in this in the Gulf, and the price of gas would go through the roof, and you won't get reelected if people are lined up paying 10, 20 bucks a gallon. So I can't understand for the life of me why you'd want to introduce nuclear technology to that cauldron of possible conflagration.
It makes absolutely no sense in it. And Saudi Arabia has shown to be a rogue state. They've been interfering in different countries and have led this, you know, senseless war in Yemen. They've turned it into the world's worst humanitarian crisis. They're blockading the country and causing hundreds of thousands of people to lose their lives. They've killed over 70,000 people. And so to give them nuclear technology and to continue to assist them, to continue to sell them weapons, makes no sense. It's just a way for Saudi to continue to assert their dominance over Iran, over whoever their enemy may be. But in fact, they're not fighting in Iran. They're fighting in Yemen. And this goes for the UAE as well. They're not at war with Iran. They're at war or are attacking Yemen, essentially, for the last 4 years. And so any weapons that we sell them are going to result in the loss of more civilian lives. And nuclear technology in the hands of a man who's been shown to be nothing but a murderer of his own citizens and a terrorizer of others abroad, it's unconscionable. It's mind-boggling that Trump would just so callously provide these technologies and these military assistances to somebody like Mohammed bin Salman.
And just in closing, it looks as though Saudi Arabia is actually losing this war in spite of their help from the United States and the enormous amount of money they've spent.
Well, they're completely incompetent. They don't have soldiers on the ground. They have mercenaries, and they've been bombing, essentially, and blockading the country, using starvation as a weapon of war, which is illegal under any international humanitarian law. And they've been, you know, they're fighting a country. The Houthis don't have an air force, and they've not been able to assert any more territory than they've had in 2015. So essentially, it's a slaughter. They've prevented people from leaving the country. They have prevented food and aid from coming in. Yemen was already the poorest country in the neighborhood and in the Middle East, and now it's one of the poorest countries in the world. And so, you know, they're incompetent at what they do, which is why they rely on the U.S. so heavily, and even then have not been able to succeed in this war.
Well, Shireen Aladimi, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Shireen Aladimi, who's a professor of education at Michigan State University. Having lived through two civil wars in her country of birth, Yemen, she has played an active role in raising awareness about the U.S.-supported Saudi-led war in Yemen since 2015. And through her work, she aims to encourage political action amongst fellow Americans to bring about an end to U.S. intervention in Yemen. And she has an article at In These Times, Why Nancy Pelosi Needs to Sue the Trump Administration Over the Yemen War. We can take a brief station break and back looking into how Trump has tied the border and immigration issues to ramping up tariffs unless Mexico stops migrant flows into the United States, which the much richer U.S. with far more resources has not been able to accomplish.
Until that day, the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality. Will remaining but a fleeting illusion to be pursued but never attained.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Catherine Russ, who's a professor of economics at the University of California, Davis, who worked for the Obama administration's Council on Economic Advisers as a senior economist for international trade and finance. She is a faculty research associate in the National Bureau of Economic Research International Trade and Investment Group and a research advisor at the Halle Institute for Economic Research in Halle, Germany, and she's been a visiting scholar at the Central Banks of Germany, Portugal, and France, and the Federal Reserve Banks of St. Louis and San Francisco. Welcome to Background Briefing, Catherine Russ.
Hi, Ian. Thanks for chatting with me.
Well, thank you. And Vice President Mike Pence and other top administration officials are meeting today with Mexico's Foreign Minister, Marcelo Ebrard. And, of course, President Trump is threatened to impose next week tariffs on Mexico if they don't stop the flow of migrants entering the United States. And this, of course, is a very tough thing for Mexico because they don't have the resources the United States have. And arguably, you know, if the United States can't stop people entering their borders, Mexico, a poorer country without the kind of resources we have, I don't know how they can solve this problem. But how do you disentangle these geopolitical problems and the fact that Donald Trump uses the border issue as a rallying cry to shore up his base? How do you extricate immigration and border issues from trade? I mean, do you think this is the appropriate weapon to be using?
The International Emergency Economic Powers Act that the administration is using to threaten these tariffs has never been used for tariffs before. Using this particular legal justification, it's still kind of uncharted territory. People are still trying to figure out whether it could even support the use of tariffs, especially in the case of immigration, because it usually applies to an extraordinary, unusual situation. Certainly, we're seeing really high levels of immigration, but, you know, immigration has been an issue for a long time, so it's hard to know whether it meets some of these criteria that the law stipulates. And so there are legal experts who are also trade experts who are debating this right now. At the same time, the president has called for higher tariffs on Mexican goods, even as a candidate in 2016. He called for pretty high tariffs on all Mexican goods. Then he threatened to withdraw from NAFTA several times, which would also increase tariffs on Mexican goods. So right now, the trade issue and the immigration issue are really melded. The threat for these tariffs came on the same day when his administration seemed to be trying to start the process of getting the new replacement for NAFTA, the USMCA, passed through Congress. He knows that, I mean, according to statements by the Senate Finance Chair, Chuck Grassley, with regard to the steel and aluminum tariffs, he knows that imposing more tariffs on Mexican goods would probably necessarily threaten the passage of this new trade agreement with Mexico. So, again, it's just hard to see, you know, where the line is between immigration policy versus trade policy, because these tariffs are consistent with his past statements on purely trade policy.
But White House officials went to the Republican caucus in the Senate and asked for their cooperation on imposing these tariffs, which are incremental to 25%. They're really quite draconian. And they were told, the White House officials were told, that there is not one person in the Senate who's going to support that. So surely that's got to get the White House's attention.
This is true. At the same time, you see some senators, like Senator Ron Johnson, went on record today saying that he wasn't sure there were the votes, even though there was a lot of opposition, he wasn't sure there were enough votes to ensure a veto-proof disapproval resolution to override the tariffs. So there's opposition, as there has been also to the steel and aluminum tariffs, for instance, but whether or not they could get enough of a majority, a two-thirds majority in the Senate and also in the House, we hear that this is unlikely to override
presidential veto of a disapproval resolution, it's really uncertain.
But if it goes through, it's not going to work. It's going to impoverish Mexico even further and create even more immigrants seeking a better livelihood north. And furthermore, doesn't Mexico have the ability to retaliate? There are a number of actual swing states that would be affected who are the biggest exporters to Mexico. That's Arizona, Michigan, Illinois. And these new tariffs could throw Texas into a recession. And obviously the 38 Electoral College votes there at play. So I don't even understand from Trump's own re-election point of view what the logic here is. Can you figure it out?
So there are two really great issues in your comment, Ian. First is what the impact of these tariffs would be on the Mexican economy. So because the Mexican economy is so interdependent with the U.S. economy through trade, naturally these tariffs would be an enormous threat to the Mexican economy, and to the degree that there's some slowdown or contraction in the Mexican economy, this move could actually end up exacerbating immigration over the medium term. I think that is, I think that is a fair speculation. The second issue is how costly it is for U.S. firms. And yeah, that's absolutely true. The United States exports $276 billion in goods to Mexico each year. A very conservative estimate from the U.S. Department of Commerce is that these exports support 1.2 million U.S. jobs. I'm in California. California is also a huge exporter to Mexico. It's California's number one export destination. And more than 50,000 American small and medium-sized companies export to Mexico. So it's not just big multinationals that stand to get hurt from this. In addition, we saw estimates today reported by Vox, by Gary Huffbauer at the Peterson Institute, that these tariffs could be extremely costly for U.S. households. So we're looking at for 5%, the 5% level that would go into effect on June 10th, about $180 per household per year, according to Gary Huffbauer. If they go up to 25%, up to $900 per household per year. These estimates are rough, but they're very much in line with estimates we've seen for other tariffs that have gone into place. So I think they're quite plausible, and this would be quite costly to many people.
And what seems counterintuitive in this whole sudden ramping up of tariffs, we already have a brewing trade war with China, and now the president's turned his attention to Mexico, threatening a huge, rapid increase in tariffs if they don't stop the flow of immigrants. At the same time, the U.S. under Trump or his government have taken away funds from these three Central American countries, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, where the problems are, where people are fleeing for their lives, and because of the instability and violence in those countries. It would make more sense to try and make life more livable in those countries for the average citizens. And you could do that for pennies on the dollar as opposed to trying to build a wall on the southern border. Furthermore, we're not helping Mexico. Mexico had to turn to the UN for money to help it. And I don't understand why, even in the short term of stopping the flow rather than going to the source and fixing the problem, the Europeans, for example, are providing money to countries in Africa like Niger. They've given them more than $1 billion to stop immigrants coming north and crossing the Mediterranean into Europe. So how can you put all the pressure on Mexico to solve a problem that America can't solve and not give them any help?
Ian, I think you just really hit the nail on the head in that this is a very difficult problem. The places where it sounds like, just according to an interview I saw with Peter Navarro earlier today on Bloomberg, that it sounds like the U.S. is requesting more activity by Mexico is in an area along the border where Mexico itself has had internal challenges and civil unrest in the past. I actually was a Peace Corps volunteer in the highlands of Guatemala about, 20 years ago, where many of these immigrants are coming from, and you see that it's arising in, very much due to long-term economic and political issues, with very high malnutrition rates pervading in some of these areas where the immigrants are coming from, just real desperation, issues of violence. So, I mean, trying to address these problems where people are seems like it could be it could make a really big difference in people's lives and their decision whether or not to try to immigrate into the United States.
So I haven't heard what happened in these White House meetings today. Did you?
I have not heard at this point. No.
No.
I only have heard that there are meetings. It was touted as some like hopeful sign that maybe the tariffs would not go into place.
Well, Navarro was crowing, saying we've already got Mexico's attention, as though they can, you know, we can beat them without costing us a dime. But I don't think that that's a realistic expectation. Sure, you've got Mexico's attention. You're going to cripple their economy. Of course, they're paying attention, but that doesn't mean that you can ask for the impossible and get it.
It's true. And this seems to be a strategy now that the administration has decided is working. So it threatened auto tariffs, and that seems to have preceded Japan coming to the table after a lot of resistance to talk about a bilateral trade deal. Prior to the threat about auto tariffs, Japan was really sort of standing firm and saying, no, we'd like you to take another look at TPP before they would come to the table for bilateral talks.
Well, what's your sense then? Is this, do you think this is to do with a real problem, or is this sort of creating a problem in order to create some headlines? And in the case of the border, keep that whole thing alive to activate Trump's base. That seems to me to be what's really going on here. And the everything else is collateral damage.
It's hard for me to comment on the politics of it. As far as economic and trade policy goes, this seems very much consistent with the trade policy that President Trump campaigned on, with the policy that he has been pursuing in kind of fits and starts since he took office. So as far as trade policy goes, this seems right down the middle for the way things have been going.
Chaos as usual. Well, I thank you for joining us, Catherine Russ.
Oh, thanks for your time, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Catherine Russ, who's a professor of economics at the University of California, Davis, who worked for the Obama administration's Council of Economic Advisors as a senior economist for international trade and finance. She's a faculty research associate in the National Bureau of Economic Research, International Trade and Investment Group, and a research advisor at the Halle Institute for Economic Research in Halle, Germany. And she has been a visiting scholar at the Central Banks of Germany, Portugal, and France, and the Federal Reserve Banks of St. Louis and San Francisco. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.